Okay, so let me take you back to page 12 and 13. We're going to review the adrenal glands first, and then we're going to work through those disorders at the bottom of that page. Okay, so from last Wednesday, we talked about the adrenal cortex, and the adrenal cortex is a portion of the adrenal gland that makes three types of steroid-based hormones. Now, knowing that they're steroids gives us a clue. How do they operate? Direct gene. Good. So they operate by direct gene activation. So does that mean the receptor, is on the plasma membrane or inside the cell? Inside the cell. Good. So all of these are corticoids, which says to us, hey, I'm made by the adrenal cortex. And it also tells us they are steroid hormones. The first type there, the mineral corticoids, includes aldosterone. What does aldosterone regulate? Blood pressure, good. What types of ions in the bloodstream are regulated? Good, sodium and potassium. And if you're retaining more sodium, what happens to the potassium? It goes out, right? So you urinate out and lose the potassium. Which of those two ions does water tend to follow? Salt, good. So the sodium is going to draw the water back in. And aldosterone usually works in cahoots with another hormone called ADH. What does that particular hormone cause you to retain?
Water.
Yep. So those two work as a pair together. Would you describe them as synergist or antagonist?
Synergist.
They're synergist. Good. Okay. So little slight difference in the way that they work. Aldosterone promotes sodium retention, and of course water follows. ADH promotes water retention. All right, so what is the number one mechanism to regulate aldosterone production? Renin-angiotensin mechanism. What is the stimulus for that mechanism? Yeah, you got it, low blood pressure, good. So what organ picks up on that low blood pressure? The kidneys, good. You know, the kidneys are filtering blood, they're removing waste products, so that's a great place for us to detect blood pressure issues. Well, renin travels to the liver, and the liver then releases a chemical called angiotensin. This is kind of a solution to the problem, because what does angiotensin do to our vessels?
Constricts,
good. What impact does constriction of your vessels have on blood pressure?
Increases,
good. Now, this is not a permanent fix. This is not a long-term solution. So we have to kick on the activation of aldosterone. So angiotensin comes full circle. Aldosterone then is going to target your kidneys. And like you told me a minute ago, what does aldosterone tell your kidneys to keep? Yep, sodium, and then water follows. Good. And in exchange for keeping the sodium, what do your kidneys dump into the urine?
Potassium.
Good. So thinking about aldosterone, when it's in effect, do you have a lot of urine that's being produced or a small amount?
Small
amount, right. So is that urine light colored or dark yellow concentrated? Yeah, it's dark yellow, it's concentrated. So when you've got small amounts of dark yellow urine, we know that there's probably some water retention that's going on there. All right, so let's go back to our big picture here. We know that the three types of hormones produced by your adrenal cortex are steroids. We've taken care of the mineral corticoid called aldosterone. What is an example of a glucocorticoid?
Cortisol.
Yeah, cortisol or its buddy cortisone. They both work in the same manner. What do they help regulate?
Sugar.
Yeah, they help regulate sugar. Good. So they're glucocorticoids. Let's talk about those for just a moment. All right. So we know that those glucocorticoids are going to regulate long-term sugar metabolism. Keep in mind that these work a little differently from insulin and glucagon, which are more of a short-term sugar regulation issue. So cortisol involves a process known as gluconeogenesis. What body parts, what processes are broken down in gluconeogenesis? Yeah, fats and proteins, good. And when you break down fats and proteins, what is being made?
Energy.
Energy, good. Glucose for energy, right. So it helps us to maintain long-term energy, especially during stressful times or when you may not be eating properly. Another issue with glucocorticoids or cortisol in general is this here. It's the resistance to stress. What does this particular hormone do to your immune system? Lowers it. Good. So do you fight off everything when you're stressed out, or do you catch everything? Catch it, yes. So you're more vulnerable now to being ill, catching diseases that come along because your immune system is not as strong as it should be. So that's actually interesting because we give people corticosteroids when they're, you know, having an organ transplant or a tissue transplant. It lowers the immune response. How does that help the person who's got the transplant? Yeah, it keeps you from fighting off the transplant, but it puts you at higher risk for infection. Yeah, so there's a good portion to it and then a bad portion to the way it works. Okay, so we've got two of our three steroids taken care of. What is the third type of steroid made by your adrenal glands? Good, gonadocorticoids. And they're, of course, sex hormones that ultimately target the gonads, whether they are ovaries or testes, to modify their activity. So we'll talk a little more about those. Okay, so I think what we need to do today is talk about the disorders. You're about halfway down page 13. So let's take Addison's first. Sometimes it is known as Addison's syndrome, Addison's disease, same thing. I think every few years they decide the word disease sounds horrible and they change it to syndrome. And then I think they decide that syndrome doesn't sound right, so they change it back to disease. So you can pick up a number of textbooks and they'll toggle between those two terms. This particular disorder is a hyposecretion issue. Hypo. The problem is a person may not make enough glucocorticoids and they may not also make enough mineral corticoids. So both aldosterone and cortisol levels may be too low. So let's run through the list here. We can attribute almost every issue to one of those two hormones. Which hormone promotes weight gain? Cortisol. Yeah, so not enough cortisol means you might experience weight loss. Okay? Cortisol also makes you feel like you can live and function in the world. If you've ever been on steroids, you know, like a Dexpack or a prednisone, then you sometimes feel like the Incredible Hulk, like you could climb buildings and, you know, tear down skyscrapers. So if you stop taking those Dexpack or prednisone pills, you oftentimes feel like you've gone from being on top of the world to being underneath the world. So cortisol and cortisone and those kinds of steroids make you feel good when they're coursing through your vessels, and then they make you feel bad when they're in deficiency. That accounts for the muscle weakness. That also accounts for the fatigue. Which of the two hormones do you think is deficient when a person experiences low blood pressure, though?
Aldosterone,
yeah. And then I'm going to skip the skin darkening for a moment. We'll come back. Again, which hormone would promote salt cravings? Pica.
Aldosterone,
yeah. So why would a person who has low aldosterone levels crave things that contain minerals and salts? What does aldosterone make you keep? Yeah, salt. So people who have low aldosterone levels may have strange, they're not really even food cravings. I've had a student in class a few semesters ago who craved baking soda, baking powder. She had a box under her desk at work, and she said she ate a good portion of that, like I think it was every day. Yeah, I mean, that's a big warning sign for something like, you know, Addison's disease. Pregnant ladies oftentimes experience cravings for weird stuff. You know, you often hear about pregnant ladies wanting dirt to eat, and that's pica. You know, that comes along with having not enough salt retention. These kinds of things can be modified with diet. They can be modified with medication, but, you know, they're usually pointing not toward necessarily a mental issue, but more a physical craving to replenish that salt. If you've ever seen that show on TLC, what is it, the My Strange Addiction?
Yeah.
They always talk about this person has a mental disorder and thinking, no, it's pica. You know, if they would just do their research, but they always talk about those people having, you know, a mental disorder. But yeah, I mean, if they're talking salt, matches, dirt, things of that sort, then it's most likely going to be a pica issue. One exception to the strange cravings is ice. Ice does not point to Addison's disease. Do you know what that points to?
Anemia.
Anemia, yeah. So strange stuff can fall in different categories. But yeah, those these salt-based food groups or items here would be a PICA issue. I do want to mention skin darkening because that doesn't really match anything else on the list. There's a hormone we haven't talked about yet called melanocyte-stimulating hormone. Melanocyte, right? Mm-hmm. So what do melanocytes make?
Melanin.
Melanin, right. Which makes you dark, exactly. So tripped into this mechanism is melanocyte-stimulating hormone that gets tripped on, and we experience skin darkening like an all-over bronzing when we have Addison's disease. So this man, JFK, was president back in the early 1960s, and it was suspected that he had Addison's disease. Back in this time period, color television was new, and a lot of people were seeing color TV for the first time, and they thought, oh, he's tan, he must be outside a lot. Well, he did play golf, I believe he was a tennis fan, and he probably was tan from being outside, but his inner circle of friends was afraid he would die in office from Addison's disease. If you know his story, of course, he was assassinated before he ever got to finish his term. But, you know, Addison's disease comes with some strange symptoms. Can you see the gums here? Okay, you know, that could be a melanoma. You know, we've had very strange cases where people have gums that have had melanoma cancer. But in this case here, they've apparently diagnosed this person with Addison's. You know, the reason that this is significant is how many of you go outside and make sure that your gums are exposed to the sunlight? You know, none of us do, right? If you're walking, if you're sitting in the sun, whatever, gums are like the last place that you're concerned about getting any sunlight. So those kinds of pigmentations that occur in places that normally don't see the sun are the warning signs for this disorder. Never mind all the issues that we saw in the previous list, like muscle weakness and weight loss. Okay. Do y'all have any questions on Addison's? Okay, it is a hyposecretion. Does that mean you make too much of it or too little of those hormones? Too little, good. Which two hormones are typically tied in with Addison's?
Aldosterone and cortisol.
Yeah, aldosterone and cortisol, good. I would think of Addison's and Cushing's as being opposite problems. Okay, Cushing's is a hypersecretion of cortisol. Hypersecretion of cortisol. So what are the two main jobs of cortisol? Break down fats, break down proteins. Regulate the sugar. Good. So break down fats, break down proteins. That is gluconeogenesis, and that helps you to regulate sugar. Okay. And then kind of an issue with it is, of course, the anti-inflammatory component. So here's the vicious cycle that sets up for a person who produces too much cortisol. The more cortisol you produce, the more fats and proteins you break down, and the higher your blood sugar goes. What do you do with excess blood sugar? Store it. Yeah, you store it back as fat. That takes care of the obesity and the moon face issue. It also takes care of stretch marks and the thin skin. People with this condition gain weight really quickly, and they end up having stretch marks over their bellies. So we also have a buffalo hump that can develop on the backs of our neck. When we're born as babies, we have a little bit of brown fat between our shoulder blades. That is supposed to last us until mom's breast milk comes in. Well, that's pretty much the last time you ever hear about brown fat. But for a person who has Cushing's, the person starts to hypersecrete cortisol, and the excess fat is actually stored on the back between the shoulder blades, once again, as brown fat. Fat everywhere else is going to be yellow fat. It's not the same kind of fat as what we have between our shoulder blades. Kind of makes me think we're camels, you know, we've got humps that form on our backs. Now, these other issues down below really don't have anything to do directly with cortisol. The more cortisol you have, you're going to be kind of irritable with that kind of situation, but we may actually hypersecrete some other hormones like epinephrine and norepinephrine. This particular issue here, hirsutism, is hair growth, especially visible in females. We're not going to notice if a male grows more hair than he normally does. But for females who don't have facial hair or chest hair, this is going to be a remarkable, noticeable trend. So which hormone do you think is being hyper-secreted for hirsutism?
Testosterone,
yeah. Produced not in a female's testes, because she doesn't have any, right? But produced where? Adrenals, yeah. Produced in her adrenals, right. And there again is that melanocyte-stimulating hormone that gets looped into this mechanism that also turns on bronzing of the skin. So I had a student in class many years ago, and she had Cushing's disease. She was a small, petite-framed person, and she came up to me after all of her Cushing's had been resolved. And she said that she was coming back to school to be a respiratory therapist. She had been spending some time doing artwork, and it wasn't really giving her a lot of financial benefits. So she decided to come back to school because she had been through Cushing's, and I think it really changed her life. When she had this disease, she said she became very irritable. There was the anxiety. She started having a little bit of facial hair that grew. There's, of course, the male pattern hair growth. And then the thing that really bothered her the most was she said she didn't drink alcohol, but she developed a beer belly that kind of looks like this. So she put herself on a diet, a very restrictive diet, of tuna fish and crackers that she stayed on for 3 months. She said that her doctor would probably ask her what she was doing with her diet, so she wanted to go in proactively with an answer. So for 3 months, she ate a very calorie-restricted diet, and she still gained weight. So what was being broken down? Muscle, yeah. So her muscle was being broken down. So she was losing lean muscle tissue and turning it into fat. All right, so she had gone through testing, and where do you think they found the problem? It was not in her adrenal gland. Pituitary. Yep, sure was in her pituitary. So which hormone do you think was being hyper-secreted? Come down one step from CRH. ACTH, exactly. So they took out her pituitary gland, and unfortunately, when you take out the pituitary, you take out your ability to regulate a whole bunch of stuff. Thyroid doesn't get regulated. Prolactin doesn't get regulated. You know, adrenals don't get regulated, ovaries don't get regulated, or testes. You know, she was female, so obviously not bad. But nonetheless, she stayed on a handful of pills because of having had that pituitary removed. So yeah, your problem could either be a pituitary tumor or an adrenal gland. In her case, it was a pituitary tumor. So you can see a little boy here before, you know, this is what they call the moon face. It's just weight gain, fatty tissue around the face. He must have had surgery, and then after there, another little girl with pituitary problem. Notice the stretch marks here. This is what, you know, they say is drug-induced. So if you stay on prednisone for a long period of time or some similar cortisol-based drug, then you can gain weight rapidly, and then you have the stretch marks to show for it. So it's a really unfortunate thing for people who do have to stay on long-term use of corticosteroids. All right, I think you can kind of see the buffalo hump here on the back of her neck. So that's not really noticeable, but when you combine it with everything else that's going on, then you start to see the symptoms line up. And another before and after picture. So he must have had some kind of surgery, either adrenals or pituitary. All right, and so our last issue down there is masculinization in women. So keep in mind there's three sets of hormones made by the adrenals. We've got mineral corticoids like aldosterone, glucocorticoids like cortisol, and what is the last set? Gonadocorticoids, good. So the example of the gonadocorticoids are mostly testosterone, a little bit of estrogen, and everybody, both males and females, make small amounts of those hormones. So when females make more testosterone in the adrenal glands than they should, we start seeing masculinizing effects. So we are going to look at a couple of pictures here of women who have had the extra effects of testosterone. So, you know, I don't know if you heard, but the circus is gone, right? Barnum and Bailey, I think last weekend was their last weekend for the circus. So if you want to catch the circus, you can't do it in the U.S. anymore. But the old joke was the bearded lady would travel with the circus. That was the way she made her living. Poor bearded lady, she had an adrenal gland problem. So, you know, back in that day, they probably had no idea what was causing her to have this full beard that you see in the picture there and another one here. So it doesn't have to be as extreme as what these ladies had. It could be something as simple as a peach fuzz that grows. Some women, when they go through menopause, start having hair growth. And that's kind of the masculinizing effect of those adrenal glands as well. It's like a sensitization against the estrogen since it's gone from those ovaries. This is a case of precocious puberty. This is a 3-year-old girl. You'll notice that she's gone through puberty. She has pubic hair and a little bit of breast formation that's going to start taking place. At 3 years old, this means that she's producing hormones that can kickstart her menstrual cycle, her ovarian cycle. You know, if 3-year-olds are bad enough, they don't need a period. So, what do you think they gave her to stop this? Give her some hormones, right? Should you give her corticotropic releasing hormone or one that shuts that one off? Yeah, inhibiting. So shut that CRH off, and that can hopefully lead to a shutdown of this particular disorder. So nowadays, if kids have precocious puberty, meaning you know they're 8 or 9 years old and they're showing full development, they can arrest puberty, kind of put them in a stalled phase. And then when they're old enough and their body's grown, then they can let the puberty cycle get turned back on. Any problems with a very young child having puberty? What happens to the skeleton?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, stop growing. Yep. So big deals for little kids, especially one this age, to have puberty. Never mind, she looks really mad. I'd be mad at 3 years old with puberty too. Okay. Just a couple of review questions for us here. Let you read this one through. Low blood pressure. Good. Y'all agree? Low blood pressure? All right. Okay. Let's see. I think we're ready for the medulla, which is over on page 14. So back when you all learned about the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems, we teach those as branches of your autonomic nervous system. Well, the sympathetic nervous system actually links in with the adrenal medulla. It is made up of nervous tissue, not endocrine tissue. So that means that the hormones made here not only can travel over a neural pathway, but they can also travel over a bloodstream pathway. Only when those chemicals are in the bloodstream should we rightfully call them hormones. If those chemicals travel from one neuron to the next, we actually should call them what? Neurotransmitters, right. So this medulla portion inside the adrenal gland is making epinephrine and what? Norepinephrine, good. Okay, so we know that the E words like excitement, embarrassment, exercise, and emergency will trip on the sympathetic nervous system. And some of the effects of the fight-or-flight response involve increasing blood glucose levels. Let's just stop there and appreciate this is not the first one to increase blood glucose. What are some other hormones that increase blood sugar? Glucocorticoids like?
Cortisol.
Good. So cortisol can do it. Now we know epinephrine and norepinephrine can raise blood sugar. And we're not even done yet because we're coming upon glucagon that also raises blood sugar. So the whole issue here is to maintain enough sugar for you to make what?
Energy.
Yeah, it makes you ATP. Good. You'll notice we increase heart rate. Epinephrine and norepinephrine increase blood pressure. They don't necessarily make you breathe faster, but they will dilate your breathing passageways. How is this a benefit to you?
More
oxygen, yeah. If something's after you, you want to get the oxygen in. Again, that's about making more ATP. So we activate from the diaphragm above. We get the brain involved. The heart and the lungs are activated to work faster. Down below the diaphragm, we're going to shut down GI activity. The gastrointestinal tract will slow, and the fact that we're going to make less urine over a period of time is also an issue when you're stressed out. So the kidneys and the digestive organs kind of take a back seat, and they wait till the emergency or exercise has passed. Okay, so hopefully this stuff is not brand new. You've seen most of this before, right? Okay. How about questions so far on anything adrenal related? Y'all so far so good? Okay. Let's see, pancreas is our last major one. That's going to be over on page 15. This is a great time for us to review. When we started this chapter last Monday, we talked about endocrine versus exocrine. Which one of those has ducts or tubes? Exocrine, yeah. So, in fact, the pancreas is both endocrine and exocrine in nature. The pancreatic duct that you see right here is an exocrine feature, and the secretions placed there actually move into the duodenum or duodenum of the small intestine, and then, you know, they act on food groups that are there. So we'll save that story for when we get to the digestive system. Instead, we're going to focus on the endocrine function. You'll notice that the pancreas is situated behind the stomach. It's looped into a piece of the small intestine. They've taken the stomach out of the way, but it would be sitting right in front of that pancreas, right about there. So when we look inside, you'll notice the pancreas has these little sets of cells. There's clusters of them here and around here. Some of these cells secrete products into that duct, which we're not going to concern ourselves with. The other cells scattered among are called islet cells. Those are the ones we want to concern ourselves with. There's two types of islet cells, alpha and what?
Beta.
Good. Which one of those cells makes glucagon?
Alpha.
Good. And of course, beta cells make?
Insulin.
If you get stuck between keeping those straight, notice that glucagon has an A, alpha starts with an A. Okay, glucagon and alpha both have those A's. Do you think that insulin and glucagon are synergist or antagonist?
Antagonist.
Good. So what does that mean they do?
Opposite,
right. Which one of these two hormones helps to raise blood sugar? Glucagon, good, and insulin lowers. We've talked about actually several hormones so far that raise blood sugar. Can you name a few for me? Cortisol, glucagon, yeah, the glucocorticoids family, good. We just talked about epinephrine, yeah, and its sidekick is known as? Norepinephrine, right. I didn't tell you this, but growth hormone raises blood sugar. So you've got all these hormones that raise blood sugar and only one that lowers it, and that's insulin. So no wonder when insulin fails or when cells become insulin resistant, you know, you've lost the battle, right? Because you've got all these hormones working constantly to raise blood sugar. It says here that both of these hormones operate under humoral control. What does that mean?
Concentration.
Yeah, good. Blood concentration levels, right. So when your blood chemistry changes and you have too much or too little blood sugar, that is going to activate the pancreas to release one of these hormones. And I turn, I hear a phone buzz, I'm like, is it me? Y'all have the same thing. It's like babies crying and mothers producing milk. It's the same at that. So insulin's an interesting hormone. If you read about this one in your textbook, it's actually related to growth hormone and what it does. It's very much tied into when you're eating and when you're full and when you're satisfied with your meal. And if what you've eaten has satisfied the chemistry in your brain as well. So your brain and your gut are very much tied together and making sure that you're getting the nutrients that you need, you know, to stay alive and stay healthy. So it's actually a much more complicated hormone than one that just simply regulates blood sugar levels. So what I'd like to do is talk to you about the terminology on your page there. They're highlighted, or actually they're bold-faced. There's big G words that are in the column under function for insulin and glucagon. Just want to spend a moment talking about those words. Okay. So if you take blood sugar test, you know, if you prick your finger or whatever and test your blood sugar, you're looking for a normal range at fasting, meaning you haven't eaten in about 8 hours, somewhere between 70 and 120 units per milliliter of blood. So we're looking at this as being a normal range for someone who has not eaten. Now, after a meal and after we've had some food, those blood sugar levels are going to increase for several hours as our body processes and stores that food and forces that energy into cells. So what we're going to do is relate insulin and glucagon to maintain these blood sugar levels. So I'm going to start you off with glucose, and we're going to watch the relationship here with glycogen. All right, so I'm going to go back in your Bio-210 brain. What is glycogen? Yeah, it's stored glucose, right? Okay, glucose is a monosaccharide. Glycogen is a polysaccharide. And you're right, we store glycogen in our muscles and liver. So let's say that you go by Krispy Kreme and they have that hot nail sign flashing. Okay, and of course, can't resist, you pull in there, get yourself a dozen donuts, you have half of them on the way to school. Right, blood sugar. So when you're having something like sugary donuts, we exceed our normal range of 70 to 120. Let's just be completely above and beyond. Let's say we're up to 300 for our blood sugar. And so, which hormone is going to be tripped on to lower that blood sugar?
Insulin.
Insulin, good. So insulin takes blood sugar levels at increase. It's going to decrease the blood sugar levels by forcing sugar into your cells, and any leftovers can be taken for storage in your muscles and your liver. So this is insulin that lowers blood sugar. The fancy word glycogenesis means making glycogen. Okay, so glycogenesis means making glycogen. It's literally the two words broken apart there. So on Monday morning, if you have your Krispy Kreme donuts, your body forces that excess sugar into your cells, and it gives you a jittery sugar high. So for 30 minutes to an hour, you're going to be burning off this sugar. And at the same time, insulin also escorts sugar into your cells, where we can then make it into glycogen in our livers and our muscles. Glycogen sticks around for about 3 days. And after that time period, if you haven't used it, you're going to store it as what? As fat, yeah. So after about 3 days, there we go. say that on Tuesday morning, you had your donuts Monday morning. On Tuesday morning, you've got a crazy hectic day. You don't get a chance to eat properly. So you're running around and you're using your supply of glucose first. Once you hit about 70, your body says, oh, I'm not going to burn off any more glucose. You're going to hit rock bottom. So we start tapping into our storage supplies of glycogen. We go to the liver and the muscles and we start breaking glycogen back down into glucose. Which hormone raises blood sugar? Glucagon, good. Name for this process is called glycogenolysis. What a word, okay? Glycogenolysis means literally breaking down glycogen. So short-term sugar regulation involves glucagon and insulin either storing glycogen or breaking it down into glucose, vice versa. So we're looking at those two hormones being a short-term regulating device for that that sugar level in the bloodstream. So what happens when you tap through your glucose, you burn through your glycogen, and you're starting to run low on blood sugar? Where do you now tap?
Fat.
Fat, yeah. So you start tapping into those fat supplies. Which hormone promotes the breakdown of fat and proteins into sugar?
Cortisol.
Yeah, cortisol. So we have a backup plan. Let's move this around here. If you need it, cortisol says, okay, I'll help you out. I will break down fats and proteins to turn them into glucose for you to be able to operate. So this big G word, gluconeogenesis, has the word new hidden in there. And of course, gluconeogenesis means we're getting sugar from new sources. Okay, normally we don't think of glucose and glycogen being related to fat, but in fact, if you need the sugar, you're going to break down those fats and proteins and make them into glucose. Gluconeo. Yep. So let's kind of think outside our box. If you're stressed out or if you're making a lot of cortisol, how do you actually gain weight from this? You may be overeating, that could do it. What if you don't eat a whole lot? How could you still gain weight from eating less calories than normal? Yeah, you may be burning off your muscle, you may be burning off your fat, and the catch is when you burn off your muscle, you break the muscle down into glucose. If you don't use the glucose, it stores as glycogen, and after about 3 days, instead of being restored as muscle, it's restored as fat, yeah. So the student that I was telling you about from years ago, that's what was happening to her with Cushing's. Her lean, healthy frame was being turned from muscle into sugar, and sugar back to fat, not back to muscle. Yeah. So people who go on a quick starvation diet hoping to drop a few pounds, guess what your body says? No, you're not. Your body says, oh, you need cortisol. You're starving. So, of course, cortisol pumps. You get high blood sugar, and then you turn it right back into fat. So people who do experience things like excess cortisol may look like they've got diabetes. Why is that? Yeah, breaking down that fat, making excess sugar. So prednisone, you know, gives people high blood sugar. If you're a diabetic, that's the last thing you need, right, is more blood sugar. And if you're trying to lose weight, pumping fat and protein, turning it into sugar, is just going to be a vicious cycle that you eventually got to break. Okay, so this is kind of a cycle that ties in the two short-term regulating hormones, glucose and see, these words are awful, aren't they? Glucagon and insulin. And then this is more of a long-term regulating hormone, it's cortisol. Any questions on these big G words or the process? Y'all feel okay so far? Okay. If we need to go back to that, let me know. Near the bottom of your page, you got a little information down there for you on diabetes mellitus. I've got three blanks for you for the cardinal signs. They are three poly issues: polyuria, polyphagia, and polydipsia. So we talked a little bit about diabetes insipidus. We know that that is a different form of diabetes, has nothing to do with blood sugar issues or insulin. What is the underlying cause for diabetes insipidus? Low ADH, low antidiuretic hormone. So in that case, a person does not retain adequate what? What does ADH make you keep?
Water.
Yeah, so totally different diabetes insipidus. This particular form of diabetes has to do with not regulating their blood sugar. So it's an insulin issue. So if you have a lot of blood sugar that you're not able to store as glucagon, glycogen, right? Then that blood sugar remains in your blood and it goes to your kidneys, and your kidneys try to excrete it into your urine. Well, we know that water loves to follow salt, but water will also follow sugar. And so water and sugar together get dumped into your urine. There's the first symptom, polyuria. Well, if you're dumping both water and sugar into your urine, we are going to be hungry then to replace our lost calories. There comes our second issue, polyphagia. And then, of course, if you're losing a lot of water that's chasing the sugar away into your urine, we're also then going to be thirsty. There's our third symptom, polydipsia. So these three symptoms are almost identical to the two symptoms we saw for diabetes insipidus. What one symptom does not share between those two forms?
Polyphagia.
Polyphagia, right. So we don't see the hunger issue with the that ADH type of diabetes. Okay, some other things that come here with this form of diabetes: nausea and vomiting. Type 1 diabetics may also have something called ketoacidosis. That comes as a side effect of breaking down fats into sugar. So let me explain what's wrong with the pancreas when a person has this form of diabetes. The pancreas is the regulatory center for blood sugar, not the brain. You know, so most of the time we talk about the brain being your regulatory center for negative feedback control. But if your pancreas fails as a regulatory center, the pancreas doesn't know that the blood sugar may already be too high. So in the case of diabetes mellitus, the body doesn't produce enough insulin, and it appears that the blood sugar may not be high enough. So cortisol gets turned on, which makes the problem of high blood sugar even worse. So this here issue, this ketoacidosis issue, comes along with having a pancreas that no longer monitors blood sugar levels properly. Without a, you know, blood stick test, without testing for blood sugar, you can simply guess whether or not somebody has high blood sugar. Hot and dry normally means they probably have high blood sugar. Cold and clammy may indicate that their blood sugar is low. So those are some signs and symptoms that a person may exhibit if they're having problems. Long-term issues include eye damage, heart damage. You know, we look at kidney damage here as well. Amputations come from having sugar in those interstitial spaces where it should not be located. So what is the difference between a type 1 and a type 2 diabetic? Good. Type 1 is juvenile. It's insulin dependent. Type 2 is adult onset. It may not be insulin dependent, although it may evolve into that form. So women who are pregnant may also exhibit gestational diabetes. That means that her blood sugar level during a glucose tolerance test was above 140 units per milliliter of blood. So unfortunately, that may cause complications for the fetus. Later in life, it may increase risk for type 2 diabetes, although it's not a direct link, but they do watch someone who's had that gestational diabetes later in life. Okay. So that should take you through page 15. How about questions on that page? Sure.
What's the difference between ketosis and
ketoacidosis? Ketosis is the process of breaking down fats, mostly fats and proteins, into sugar. And a side effect is ketone body production, but it's the ketone bodies that actually make your blood acidic, so then that causes ketoacidosis. So I would say that gluconeogenesis causes ketosis, which is breakdown of fats, and then ketosis leads to ketoacidosis, which is then the fruity breath of odor. Okay. How about other questions so far? I normally don't get time to cover page 16, but I think we've got time today to hit that. So why don't we go ahead and run through pineal gland and thymus gland. Sometimes called the pineal body, this particular gland is deep inside the brain. It is not near the pituitary, which is down here. It's in fact closer to the midbrain at the back portion of this corpus callosum. So right there, that little gland sits. What is the name of the hormone produced by the pineal gland?
Melatonin.
Melatonin, good. Not to be confused with melanin, right? Okay, so melanin is a skin pigment. Melatonin is a hormone that helps to regulate what?
Sleep,
right. So we, of course, can buy melatonin in pretty much anywhere that sells those kinds of over-the-counter medications. It is meant to induce a normal sleep cycle. So we do know that it's involved in that. But look at all the other things we think it's involved in. We think it's involved in making animals change coat color. You know, in the wintertime, an animal may have a white coat. In the summertime, it may be brown. So we think that melatonin drives that. We also think it is related to the wintertime blues. You know, a lot of people have seasonal affective disorder. They feel down in the dumps in the wintertime. And interestingly, people who travel on airplanes that work against the cycle of the earth, you know, may experience jet lag. So, of course, we think that jet lag and the light changes are also related to melatonin levels. And this is interesting. We also think that female menstrual cycles, which are on average 28 days, may also be regulated somewhat by melatonin levels. So, again, this is light exposure. People who are blind have difficulty with their melatonin levels. Why is that? Can't see the light yet. So that is in fact what regulates melatonin, light levels in your exposure to light. So, you know, when you're inside all day exposed to these artificial lights, no wonder we have trouble unwinding later in the day and going to sleep at night. We're wired up on artificial light. We don't get the natural decline as the day progresses, especially in the wintertime of those light levels. So this artificial lighting, I know, causes a little bit of issue with melatonin levels. All right. Last one there is called the thymus gland. Where is it located? Yeah, under the sternum, over the heart. And during what period of your life is it most active?
Younger,
right. So by the time you're, say, late teenage years, this particular gland is atrophying, meaning it's drying up and shriveling up. Boy, you didn't know by the late teenage years you'd have something starting to go on you, but yep, this one is going to be pretty much done by the time you reach around age 20. So why is it so important to have a thymus gland during your younger years? What does it produce? Thymosin, yeah. So thymosin is a hormone that helps to program white blood cells, yeah, called T cells. So you may say, okay, by the time I'm age 20, I don't have a thymus gland anymore. How do I program white blood cells to fight foreign invaders? Are you done for life at age 20? Hopefully not. So another T location picks up the job, and that's your tonsils. They too can produce a robust white blood cell community that can still fight infection even after your thymus gland is done in your late teenage years. So, you know, that's why removing tonsils is not necessarily the best thing, because they're still programming your blood cells, you know, long after that thymus gland is gone. You should still have a set left behind. They'll take out the tonsils, which are the pharyngeal tonsils, and they'll take out the adenoids above your soft palate. They'll leave the linguals, so you'll still have a set. All right. Why don't we do a break? And when you come back, we'll start with blood typing. Let's see. How about, let's do about 2:10 on that clock, and then we'll get started with blood typing. Okay, so let's get into blood typing, which is going to do the next chapter actually in reverse. I thought I would save the easier content at the beginning of the chapter for after we come back from Memorial Day, and I wanted to give you plenty of time to work on blood typing between now and test number one. So, in fact, we're going to start with page 29. We'll do 29, 30, and 31, and then we'll go backwards and do the beginning of the chapter. So what is your comfort level with blood typing? You've heard of blood typing, right? Okay, so are you comfortable with the concept of an antigen, antibodies? Okay, how about you've heard of ABO and you've heard of RH? Okay, so we do the approach here in lecture a little different from lab. What we do in lab is we say, okay, you've got a patient, you're gonna blood type this person, and you're working from an unknown standpoint. Well, here in lecture, we do it from knowing what our blood types are and talking about compatibility issues. So first thing I'd like to mention is there is a fantastic website that will help you master these terms, and it is the Nobel Prize website that lets you do blood typing exercises over and over. When you go through their website, they actually give you the option of doing this a number of different ways. They give you a quick game, or mission-based game, and they'll continue giving you patients until you start getting them right. So they'll look for compatibility issues, so you know what's good to go with another blood type and that type of thing. So this website is not only in our D2L announcements, but I also emailed it to you this morning, so you may want to check your tech email because there's a link to the Nobel Prize website game in there. Okay. So what I'd like to do is introduce you to some basic terminology so we can appreciate how the ABO blood groups and the RH blood groups operate. So, you know, back, say, 100 or more years ago, scientists were starting to understand that there were compatibility issues with blood typing. Unfortunately, when they started doing transfusions about 100 and some years ago, there were people that died because they didn't understand the compatibility rules fully. Nowadays, we have a much better grasp on those compatibility rules, and so that's what we're going to discuss today. So there's two terms here, antigens and antibodies, and I want to introduce this related not to blood typing, but to the flu. So every fall and every winter, these drugstores like CVS and Walgreens advertise their flu vaccines. And you say, well, hey, I had a flu vaccine 5 or 10 years ago. Why do I need to get your flu vaccine this winter? Well, the vaccine introduces into you some antigens that your body will then form antibodies against. And every year they anticipate the flu antigen changing shape just a little bit so that your body no longer recognizes the old antigen. So it's just enough of a mutation there to trigger your immune system into a new reaction. So what is the vaccine doing for you? It's triggering your immune system to build these Y-shaped antibodies that look sort of like this. And these antibodies will be built very specifically to the antigens that are invading your body. Well, the good news is with most vaccines, they don't give you anything live that's going to make you sick. I know people sometimes get really bad symptoms from flu vaccines, but it's not meant to invoke a full-on flu virus where you're going to be sick for days and weeks. It's just enough to trigger your immune system to build these antibodies, these Y-shaped antibodies, against that foreign antigen. So the case here of the flu is an illustration of an antigen. An antigen is a foreign substance that enters your body that your body recognizes as being foreign, and it triggers an immune response by making your white blood cells release these Y-shaped proteins known as antibodies. You actually have your own antigens. They're called self-antigens, and for the most part, you recognize those as being part of you. And I say for the most part because there are cases of autoimmune disorders where your body then decides, hey, that doesn't belong here, and we're going to fight it and get rid of it. Multiple sclerosis is like that. Thyroid disease is like that. Rheumatoid arthritis, we could keep on listing. There's a lot of diseases where the body fails to recognize your own antigens as self-antigens. Now, most of the time, again, like with blood cells, we're going to recognize our own blood cells as our own. We only make antibodies when antigens are introduced that are foreign to us. So antibodies are made by white blood cells. They are Y-shaped proteins, and they circulate in your blood plasma. And of course, when we encounter a foreign antigen, they're there, they're ready, and they can perform a reaction that binds and clumps those foreign antigens. All right, so far so good. Okay, so what are the proteins that your body uses to recognize you as you? Antigens or antibodies?
Antigens,
right. And what do you use to fight against foreign antigens?
Antibodies,
good. Technically, the word antibody is a shortening of antigen generator. So the antibody term there actually means that it's generated in response to foreign antigens. Okay, so what I'd like to do is talk to you about the ABO blood group in relationship to antigens and antibodies. And our blood cells have these proteins on the surfaces that we recognize as self or our own. That's fine because we look at them and say, hey, that belongs to us. There's no point in fighting that off. So back when you learned about the glycocalyx structure, there's some surface features here that are used to recognize us as, you know, part of our own bodies. So those are some of the antigens that help to form the ABO blood groups. The ABO blood group is just our most commonly used blood typing group, and it's based on two antigens, simply A or B. Okay, and by the way, I'm on the blanks on the middle of page 29. This is face value. If you have the antigen, that tells you the blood type. So the next question there says, if you have no antigens, your blood type is O. If you have both antigens, A and B, your blood type is AB. What is your blood type if you only have antigen A?
A,
good. And if you only have antigen B, you're B. So the last questions there, the universal donor and universal recipient, that's a loaded question. So I'd like to explain that to you before we talk about that. And I want to mention that, you know, by the time you're around 3 to 5 years old, you have actually been sensitized to all the antigens. So let's take A, for instance.
My blood type is A, and even though I've never had a blood transfusion, I have been sensitized against blood type B. So how in the world can you be sensitized to a foreign blood type even though you've never had a transfusion?
Your mom?
Possibly mom? How else? Well, by the time you're age 5, you've been exposed to enough of the world that you have been sensitized against bacteria and food products that contain these foreign blood types. So by the time you're around 5, you've actually built up an army of antibodies that will fight that foreign antigen. So even though I'm blood type A and I've never had a transfusion, I carry in my blood plasma anti-B antibodies. So along comes a transfusion 20 years later, 50 years later, I've got a small army of anti-B antibodies that are ready to attack. So first time you have that transfusion of a foreign blood type, the transfusion reaction is not tremendous. But the second time you have that foreign transfusion, you've got an army ready to go. So the second reaction is going to be much more severe than the first one. So it's interesting that we're actually sensitized against foreign blood types during those first few years of life. Let's take another one. Let's say that my blood type is O. If my blood type is O, what antigens have I never seen? A and B. So by the time I'm 5 years old, I have now built antibodies against antigen A and antigen B. So along comes a transfusion many years later, and I've already got a circulating population of antibodies ready to go. So even if you're O, you're going to have a circulating population, very small group, of antibodies against those foreign antigens. Let me caution you against saying antibody A or antibody B, because if we're loose with our language, we can get confused, and I've seen it happen on test time. So when you're talking about antibodies, I encourage you to be very specific. If you're talking about an antibody against A, we call it an anti-A antibody. And if you're talking about one against B, it's specifically an anti-B antibody. That way you keep your language very tight and it keeps you from getting confused. Let's do another one. Let's say that we have blood type AB, which is right here. If your blood type is AB, by the time you're 5 years old, do you need any anti-A or anti-B antibodies?
No.
Why not?
No.
You got them, right? They're what we consider self, so there's no point in creating antibodies to fight yourself. So the AB blood type has no circulating anti-A or anti-B antibodies. Boy, what a mouthful that is to keep straight. Okay, so that takes us to the next issue here, which is that universal donor and universal recipient. The universal donor is traditionally known as blood type O, and the recipient is traditionally known as AB. So here's why I wanted to give you a little background information before we headed into that. If your blood type is O, you have no antigens on the surface of your red blood cell. But circulating in your blood plasma, you have some antibodies. What are they?
Anti-A and anti-B.
Anti-A and anti-B. So if you are receiving whole blood, and you're getting not only the blood cells, but you're also getting the plasma with the antibodies in there, then you're not only getting blood that has no antigens, but you're getting the antibodies against that foreign blood type. So let me put it to you this way. Let's go back to this one. I'm A, and we're going to get a blood transfusion of O. If I get the whole blood transfusion, do you see any issues here? Blood cell-wise, are we compatible? Okay, this is me. I'm A. And we're going to give the A person some O blood. Any issues here?
No.
No issues, right? Because there's nothing on the surface of the O that screams I'm foreign, right? In fact, there's nothing there to set off any bells or whistles. So blood cell-wise, we're compatible, okay? Let's see. Does it matter that I'm getting anti-B antibodies? I'm A. Okay. Okay, so I'm A. It doesn't really matter that I'm getting anti-B antibodies. Does it matter that I'm getting anti-A antibodies? What do they fight? A, yeah, so there we go. We've got an antibody coming in that whole blood transfusion that ultimately can bind and attack my own blood. So if you're getting a whole blood transfusion, there is a small risk there of agglutination from the foreign blood type coming into the body with those antibodies. Okay? So is it enough to say, no, we're not going to have a blood transfusion? Probably not, you know, because it's a life or death matter when they do the transfusion. They'll take a cold bag out of the fridge, they'll hook you up to it and let it go at that. So the body eventually gets rid of these foreign antibodies and it's out of the system, and we're not likely to see that particular type again. Let's do another example. Let's say that we have blood type AB, okay? Does AB carry any antibodies? Okay, no antibodies there. We want to do a transfusion where we're getting B blood to AB blood. Compatibility-wise with antigens, are there any issues? So antigens were good, right? Okay, so what antibodies does AB blood, B blood carry? Anti-A antibodies. So when we give the anti-A antibodies to the AB person, we have a small risk of agglutination, yes, a transfusion reaction. So I just wanted to mention that because when we talk about the universal donor and recipient, we have to appreciate there's a small risk of a transfusion reaction there, but it's not a great enough risk for us to completely eliminate that transfusion altogether. So there's two things we're looking at. We're looking to see if the antigens are compatible, and then we're also looking if it's whole blood to see if the antibody poses any problem to that other blood type doing the receiving. Okay, so I know this is a lot to absorb at once. Do you have any questions so far?
Why wouldn't the universal donor be O negative?
It technically is, but since I hadn't introduced RH,
okay.
Yeah, but you're exactly right. Negative is the best one. Yep. Okay. So I want to show you what agglutination looks like. This is technically how it works. It's antibodies binding to foreign antigens, and since they're Y-shaped, they can theoretically bind to multiple blood cells at the same time. When you do this, you cross-link those blood cells together. You create a clump called an agglutinogen or agglutination, and that actually floats through your kidneys, looking something like this. See that big clump there by the arrow? Or this. So unfortunately, when that goes through your tiny kidney capillaries, that can rip holes in your kidney capillaries, causing big problems in terms of bleeding in the kidneys. So we think of these kinds of agglutination reactions as being rather dangerous if they're let to go to this stage. Okay, so why don't we go on to the RH factor for just a moment. And we're going to have to flip on over to page 30 for the RH factor. Okay, so this RH issue is a totally separate, different blood type altogether, but it's a common blood type that we use for doing blood typing, and we often combine it with that ABO blood group. So if you have the RH factor on your blood cells, you are one of about 85% of the population who carries a positive test for the RH factor. So we say that you are RH positive if you do in fact have the RH antigen on your blood cells. Okay, so those who do possess the RH factor have alternately what's known as the D antigen. Just wanted to put that out there in case you happen to see that somewhere. RH positive is the same thing as having the D blood type. Okay, and those who don't have the RH factor are considered to be RH negative. If you're RH negative, you don't have it. So let's put it this way. If you have a flu test done, and they come back and they say you're positive for the flu, what does that mean?
Yeah,
you got the flu. Yeah, and if you're negative for it, you don't have it. So same concept here. If you're positive for the Rh factor, you've got that particular antigen. Those who are negative don't have that antigen on their blood cell surfaces. So notice that 85% of us carry the Rh factor. Only a small portion do not have that Rh antigen. And in certain ethnic groups, it's as many as 100% of that population that carries an Rh factor. So, you know, depending on what your background is, you may, in fact, have everybody in your ethnic group carry that Rh antigen. So interesting stuff about the Rh factor. You're not actually sensitized against this particular antigen growing up. So if you've never had a transfusion and you're Rh negative, you will not have formed anti-Rh antibodies against the Rh antigen. Okay, so unlike the ABO blood group, where you actually do form antibodies even without an exposure to a foreign antigen through transfusion, Rh is a little different in that aspect. I'm just checking to see if anybody needs this screen. So transfusions and pregnancy works the same way for the Rh factor. The issue is for those who are negative. If you're positive, you're good to go, okay? If you're positive, do you need to build antibodies against the Rh factor? No, because you'd be attacking yourself, right? So if you're positive, this is not your story. So for most of us, this is not our concern. The concern here is for those who are negative, meaning what? You don't have the Rh factor, right? So if you're Rh negative, let's take a pregnant mom, for instance. During her pregnancy, her body's bigger, the fetus's body is smaller. As the fetus's body grows, the fetus may in fact be a positive, you know, Rh factor. So mom's placenta usually blocks most items from traveling. But in the case here, mom may be sensitized against the fetus's blood type. What happens is mom starts building anti-Rh antibodies. These can cross the placenta to the fetus, and assuming the fetus is positive, what happens to the fetus's blood? It actually attacks the baby. Yeah. Packs the baby's blood. So in the first instance of this, the reaction is mild because it takes most of the pregnancy for mom to start building up a population of anti-Rh antibodies, okay? Same thing with the transfusion reaction. If you're Rh negative, they accidentally or maybe purposely give you blood that is positive. They'll give you a shot called Rogam. And what does that prevent from happening? Yeah, the making of these are anti-Rh antibodies, okay? So it takes time for those antibodies to build, and they may give you a shot that prevents their buildup. So here's the issue. If you are not suppressed with your antibody formation after the first exposure, you now have a circulating population of anti-Rh antibodies. This is a concern for the person who is negative and may receive a transfusion of positive blood, or for the mom who is negative and may in fact be pregnant with a second Rh positive baby. So compare the population of antibodies. First pregnancy was what? Yeah, not too many, right? Second pregnancy, what about these anti-Rh antibodies? A lot more, right? So she's got a lot more antibodies in circulation. These cross the placenta, they bind and attack these foreign antigens on the baby's blood, and this is a much more severe reaction. In fact, it can cause all sorts of birth problems. And the issue here is called hemolytic disease of the newborn. What do you think happens to babies that are subjected to basically being under fire the entire time they're in mother's womb? Yeah, brain damage, hypoxia, meaning low oxygen, okay? So we see all sorts of issues arise, maybe a stillborn baby. And so this is all due to an antibody crossing from mom's blood to baby's blood, attacking the foreign antigens. So I think about the poor mother, say, 150 years ago, who didn't have any idea this stuff was happening. She had one healthy baby, and that one was probably positive. Her second pregnancy, her third pregnancy, her however many she had, all resulted in probably stillborn babies or babies that were born with problems, severe problems. So she probably felt she'd been cursed and had no idea that those babies were all positive. And in fact, her body was doing the attacking in the form of these anti-Rh antibodies. So the alternate name for this is it's on your worksheet there, erythroblastosis fetalis. Mm-hmm. Boy, what a word. Mm-hmm. Okay, bottom of page 30 there, number 3, erythroblastosis fetalis. The easier to say name is hemolytic disease of the newborn. But nonetheless, you can see what happens to the red blood cells. They're ruptured, they clump together, they create all sorts of problems for transporting oxygen. And boy, they can rip the heck out of capillaries when they ride through in clumps. Okay, so what I'd like to do now is go over a few of the pieces of page 31, and then I'm going to cut you loose to finish that. Okay, so let's hit A positive blood first. We're combining the ABO blood group and the Rh factor all as one blood type. So a person who has A positive blood actually carries two different antigens. What are they? A and Rh. We've only talked about three antigens today. We've talked about antigens A and B and Rh. So the only one we haven't discussed is B. This person would then form antibodies against blood type B. That's the one that's foreign to this particular blood type. So here's the catch. Who can this person receive blood from? Obviously themselves, right? A positive, A negative, O positive, okay? And O negative. So I encourage you not to memorize this chart, but to use the chart. Okay, I know that's hard to do, but there's 50 practice problems on the next page. You can work yourself silly on blood types. But I know one tripping point for this is the positive-negative. If you are positive, you can get both positive and negative blood. It's better to be positive because you can get both types. If you're negative, you only get what?
Negative
blood, right. But in an emergency, they give you whatever bag they have and worry about the transfusion reaction later. But ideally, we should avoid giving positive blood to negative people. Let's see. We've got an A positive person who has walked into the Red Cross and wants to give away his blood. And this blood can be given, obviously, to our own blood type. And who else can get A positive blood?
AB
positive. Anybody else? Can I give A positive to O positive? Because O positive will fight the A antigen, yeah. So that would not be a good compatibility. All right, let's hit A negative. A antigen, good. How about the Rh factor?
No.
Okay, antibodies we would build?
B.
So anti-B and anti-Rh. Gets A negative and?
O negative.
O negative, good. Why can't we give positive blood to that A negative person? I would form anti-Rh antibodies, right? Okay. I love riding by the Red Cross here in Florence because they have on their sign, I need A, B, A, B, and O. And I'm thinking, well, which ones don't you need? Because that's everything, right? But they really, really want those negative blood types because you can give those to your negatives and your positives, right? So it's better off getting those negative blood types for that reason. Yeah, thank you. I'm thinking transfusion give, not receive away. Yeah, AB positive and, whoops, what's the other one? AB negative. Good. Thanks for catching that. So now that we've patterned the first two, let me go ahead and let you do B positive and B negative on your own, and then we'll check those before we keep moving. So I'll leave these B ones up here for you guys to check. You okay with the B positive and B negative? That's correct, right. So let me show you a pattern here. Not that you necessarily want to memorize the pattern, it's just something to appreciate. When you're talking about who you can receive blood from, look at all these columns here. Who you're receiving from is not going to cause your antibodies to fight anything. So you'll notice that for A positive, we didn't get anything with B because our antibody against B would be activated. Likewise, if you're B, we didn't get anything with A. So we're not violating our antibody you know, issues there. In terms of who you're giving that blood away to, we didn't violate anything to do with their antigens. So when we're A positive, we didn't introduce any new antigens when we gave it to AB positive. They've seen those antigens before. So we're looking at antigen compatibility when we look at who we can give that blood away to. All right, would you like me to help you work through O's and ABs, or do you feel good working through those? Working through, okay. I'm gonna erase this, just check it, anybody need it? All right, let's say we've got AB positive next. What antigens does this one carry?
A, B, and RH.
Yeah, all of them, right? Guess why they like the plasma at donation places for AB positive blood? AB positive blood has no antibodies in the plasma. So they love that plasma because there's nothing in there that's going to cause any reactions when they give it to somebody else. Let's see. A person with AB positive blood can receive blood, though, from everybody. Yeah, so we'll just go ahead and make a list up there, both positives and negatives. The only person or type that AB can give to is
AB.
AB, yeah. Why can't AB positive give to B positive blood? We can't give AB positive to A. We can't give it to B because of the A. And we can't give AB positive to O because of
A and B.
So for every one of these, there's an issue. The only one where there's no antigen issue is to self. Okay, so that's going to be a no there for those. Let me give you a moment to try AB negative. So what is it about negative? Can they get positive blood?
No.
They can only get negative. And if you're AB negative, you can walk in the Red Cross and give it to AB positive and AB negative. So let's work through O positive. What antigens are carried here?
RH.
Yeah, RH. This person would form antibodies against?
A.
Yeah, anti-A, anti-B. And you can get two blood types if you're O positive.
O positive.
Yeah, O positive and O negative, right? blood banks love you, O, because you can give it away to...
For O positive.
Okay. Yeah, you can give it away to yourself.
A positive.
And, yep. So that's back as the most common blood type in the U.S. It's around 40% of the population. So, you know, there's good news out there for people who need blood transfusions. O positive is easy to come by. But since negative blood is so rare, it's going to be a much more rare blood form with O negative. The only, well, there's no antigens there, right? And how about antibodies formed by that blood? Yeah, you'd have all three, anti-A, anti-B, anti-RH. And you can only get
O negative,
yeah. Okay, and then of course the blood banks love you even more.
Everybody,
yeah. So don't memorize the chart. I know you're not going to listen to me, right? If you can, work it until you get it right. And I gave you 50 problems on page 32. I know if you get through 20, you're like, I can do this in my sleep. Just stop, you know. But if you need the practice, I wanted to make sure you had plenty of practice. I hope that by the time we get back together after Memorial Day, that you'll feel good with your blood typing. Try that Nobel Prize website, and I hope you guys have a great Memorial Day weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.